Welcome to Volume 3 in the series, South Pender Pioneer Families, with Lynn Marsh. This series is dedicated to learning about the unique and important history of South Pender Pioneer Families and their connection to Stais, South Pender Island, and the surrounding Salish Sea. Lynn, the first grandchild of Dora and Arthur Crane, will speak about the Crane's family experience living on South Pender Island beginning in 1921. Based on stories from her mother Barbara's memoirs, one of Dora and Arthur's four children, Lynn will weave a great story about the family's time living on South Pender during the 1920s and 30s. She will describe the personalities and values of her grandparents, the adventurous activities the children engaged in while on the island, how the family chose Pender as a place to live, and so much more. This recording was made in January 2024 at Lynn's home in Victoria and is made possible with grants administered by the South Pender Historical Society. I'm your host, Chris Wagluck, and it is my pleasure to present this series to you. My voice has been extracted from this final audio in order to give maximum time and clarity to the interviewee to communicate and share their stories. Thank you for listening. Here is Lynn sharing the Crane family story.
My name is Lynn Marsh. I am the first grandchild of Dora and Arthur Crane, who arrived at Pender Island in 1921. My grandfather, Arthur Crane, was born in Northern England and was an only child. He had a very unfortunate childhood in that his father, who was a musician, an organist, married a gal who was from a large family and I assume was thought to have married beneath herself. And probably that was part of the reason they migrated and went to South Africa. And he was very busy, and my grandfather, who was an only child. Unfortunately, his mother died when he was probably 5 or 6. And he was basically all alone. His father was very, very affected by that, losing his wife that early, and raising a small child by himself when he was busy. And so my grandfather basically raised himself in boarding houses and things like that. He just killed time until he grew and had a very, very lonely and unhappy childhood. I say this because that leads into the freedom that their kids had when they were growing up. So after he was older, his father had become an alcoholic, total alcoholic. He was just, my grandfather babysat him for many years. And he then took a holiday with a friend of his to Parksville to have a look at this new place that everybody was talking about that was so wonderful, British Columbia, actually Vancouver Island specifically. So when he was up there, he ran into my grandmother on the beach one day. My grandmother was visiting her brother who had relocated to Parksville. So they met up on the beach in Parksville. They were both of a certain age. I think they were probably really, really unhappy with their existing lives. My grandfather would have been 36, my grandmother 32, which was old for a single woman. And it was a little unusual even for a man. And they got along very well, and they got to talking about life and things like that. And the gist of it was that my grandmother went back to England and prepared herself to get married. He went back to South Africa. She had money that she gave him, and he went to agricultural school, which was his big dream. My grandmother came from a family where they did have money, but it wasn't a stimulating time for a woman to be sitting around unmarried. Nothing happened. She was probably very understimulated. He, however, had had a very traumatic life up to that point. So an unlikely partnership, and fairly quickly, because they didn't have that much time in Parksville to really get to know each other. She went home, packed up her stuff, moved to South Africa, and they started having a family. He loved South Africa. He had 100 cattle, and they grew several crops. My grandmother, who'd had people waiting on her all her life, had to start running a household with the help of the locals, of course. And they had people coming in to help them and to help with the cattle. They had two little girls. Marjorie was the oldest, and Mary was the second oldest. So that was fine until about 1918. I researched Africa at the time. They were starting to get a little unpredictable, and there was a very large flu epidemic going on, and my grandfather had some kind of a heart condition that his doctor recommended he find a better climate. So they both sort of thought, okay, well, let's try the island, let's go to Parksville. Then on the ship, when they got to Japan, they got dumped off because they were taking troops here and there, and they weren't a priority. They sat in Japan for, I think it was 6 months, and my mother was born. So my poor grandmother leaves Africa with two small toddlers, and she's now got an infant. They made it to Parksville, to her brother's place. They bought a house in Parksville, and then there became family issues, again, a problem with family money going to someone who was beneath them, I think was probably the problem, from what I've gathered and from what they've said. Her favorite brother was giving her a hard time, and they decided they didn't need this. My grandfather started looking around for an interesting place, and lo and behold, he was recommended South Pender, took a trip over and said, this is it. So they packed. Oh, before they packed up, my grandmother's sister, half-sister, arrived with a little boy in tow. And the two older sisters, half-sisters, had adopted this child. This was very kind of an in thing to do at this time in England, because women were starting to go out now and to network. Very interesting time for the women, because up until that point, they'd basically been staying home and waiting to get married. So they were all dotting about and having a wonderful time starting clubs and things like that. And one of the big things was through a group they called the Friendly Club. It was very big, and it actually ended up extending through all of the colonies. They were establishing these friendly clubs. And what they were trying to do was to assist young women who didn't come from good families to learn how to dress and how to present themselves, and, you know, was with very good intentions. Where the actual adoption of this little boy came from, we didn't know. There was no details. I've never been able to find out. He did have a birth certificate. So he arrives, and they pleaded with my grandmother to take this little fellow, young Alan, who was a year older than their oldest child, Marjorie, and they agreed. So when my grandmother and grandfather arrived on Pender, they arrived with two toddlers, an infant, and a newly adopted son. Marjorie and Mary were born in Africa. My mother, Barbara, known as Bugs, was born in Japan on the way back. And then young Alan was adopted in Parksville. So my poor grandmother, with very little to help her, with very little reference, was going to be looking after seven people and a dog, the dog Diana Diogenes Crane. She was very important to them. Now she's got to look after them, start making their meals, and with nothing to start with. And away they go, off to Pender Island. She has no idea how to do anything. She's got to start from scratch. There's nothing there. She has to figure out how to make butter. She has to figure out how to make bread. Just absolutely helpless. But they had a wonderful time, apparently. They were a super close family, very close and very, very supportive. And what else can I say about that? I guess probably the big thing is that she and my grandfather, Arthur, were totally different in personality. They were almost exact opposites. Because he had had to do everything himself, he was extremely independent. Everything he knew, he had learned himself. He was very, very fond of good music and good reading, good literature. Completely self-taught. He knew them all. He was very knowledgeable on things like that. He tried very hard to sort of establish himself in this world. He was very good with my grandmother's money, her estate. The whole thing was put into Pender Island in the family. And he was an excellent provider. There wasn't anything he couldn't do on that island. He could build and look after crops and just do everything. He built the children a huge gymnasium, a big wood gymnasium set that there was nothing you couldn't do on it. It had swings and climbing things, and he was a busy man, but that was a priority as far as he was concerned. That had to be done. It was important, crucial. Then she was, of course, not particularly well educated because that wasn't important. She was extremely traditional, very religious, very, very royalist. The royalty was next to godliness. Very important to her. She was quiet. She was creative. She loved to write poetry. And she taught all the kids poetry, any of the kids that were hanging around. Everybody had to write poems about each other and whatnot, you know, and she wrote poems about all of the important things in her life. She had a beautiful garden, huge garden. I've heard people talk about her white carnations. She had giant white carnations that you could smell for miles in the heat of the summer, drifting on the heat waves several miles away. She loved writing stories. She loved children, animals, nature. But in addition to that, she was also very homesick for England, as people usually are until they make their first trip back. And unfortunately, she was never able to do that. She wasn't unhappy about the island. She loved the island, but there was always something that wasn't right. And I think it was just she missed her home, and she never saw them again after she left to go to Africa. And so as a result of her childhood and inactivity and everything, she was the worrier. My grandfather didn't have a worry in the world. He was gung-ho. Straight on. Let's go. Do it. Just do it. Don't worry about it. Do it. She couldn't help it. And when they were raising their kids, my grandfather was always, they'll look after themselves. They won't do anything they can't handle. And she would, of course, say, is this true? Do I know this for sure? You know? So it was quite an experience for her. And as far as my grandmother was concerned, even though she had a very low profile, they did their community duties. They would go to the community things and listen to the things that were going on. We'd find their name on lists of attendees at various things around for the church and the school and that kind of thing. So they really weren't not involved with the community. I think they were a little bit involved. Surprising we hadn't found out more about it. My grandfather, his personality was exactly the opposite because he taught himself everything. He was extremely athletic, which is why he put so much importance on the kids being outside and running around and doing whatever they wanted to do as far as he was concerned. He had a beautiful tenor voice, and the only reason he went to church was because he liked to sing, and he liked the choir, and he loved the music and whatnot. But he just agreed that if the church was important to her, well, he could keep himself busy with that. I guess he didn't get to sing much in Pender because they didn't actually put the church together until 1938. That was when the church opened, and they had by that time relocated to Esquimalt and wouldn't have got to sing in it. But he was a competitive sculler in South Africa of longboats with the teams, and he was a competitive tennis player and a can-do person. There was only one thing he could not do. He could not slaughter their pets, which they ate. So he would have to get the animals taken away and packaged up as meat. He couldn't handle that. I don't think anybody ever saw anything else he couldn't handle. But as a result of his stressful, very, very insecure childhood, he felt it really important that the kids be given every chance they can to build up their own confidence. And he'd had to work at it, obviously, because it was super important to him. So they had a little bit of a difference in their attitudes towards the kids. My grandmother primarily did games and poetry and fun things. When they arrived on South Pender in 1921, they had a lot of things to pull together, starting with absolutely nothing. And I've often got the impression that people felt that they really weren't too involved in the community, that they stayed on their own quite a bit. But they actually arrived with a bad start for one reason, because my grandfather, this is a rumor that I heard, and I know nothing more about it. I've never heard about it from the kids, but I heard it from somebody on the island talking about the fact that my grandfather arrived apparently with a boat, and people told him he could not harbor the boat in Camp Bay. My grandfather considered himself probably a boat expert because he sculled. And I guess he's done some sailing, I don't know, but he really didn't think that was a big deal. Of course he was going to harbor the boat on Camp Bay, even though they only owned half of Camp Bay and then the property behind it. As the story goes, as I heard, he brought the boat in and he anchored it, and it got smashed to pieces. Must have been the winter, I don't know. Never any other mention about this boat, never heard it mentioned in any way. So maybe a rumor, maybe not. Another thing that happened was when they first arrived, they rented a house at Ingo's Corner. I don't know if Ingo's Corner is still there. And they rented this house and it burned down, which was extremely, extremely unnerving for everybody. Most specifically for the owner, of course. He had lived on Pender for a few years until he went away for World War I. And when he came back, he got married and moved to maybe Main Island. Anyway, he was living on one of the other islands and renting out this property for income, of course. And I don't know what the settlement was. I never heard it mentioned. Everybody's heard about the fire. It was a very big thing. One of the family anecdotes was little Mary came running up the hill to see what all the action, everybody on the island as far as, well, it was not many people on the island, but as anybody who could get in touch was there. They were all running around trying to do something about this fire. And little Mary came running up the hill, stood there with her hands on her hips and said, "Oh, what a nuisance." And it was flattened completely. The cranes lost a lot of stuff. I don't know if the cause of the fire was ever found out. I don't know what the settlement was. After the fire, there's no record of where they stayed. The girls don't remember. They were quite small at the time, since they were infants practically. Well, they were toddlers. They did not have any memory of any more about that. And of course, out of sight, out of mind, it was just a big fire and they didn't know any more about it. So they, at that time, were already beginning the construction of the house, which my grandfather had designed, basically, had planned it off the houses that they built in South Africa, which had large, wide verandas all the way around the house with a big overhang on it, which was absolutely fantastic for everything, particularly in the summer, but it kept the kids busy all winter long, whether it was raining or snowing, it didn't matter. They were out there roller skating and, you know, kicking things around. It was a very large house. Well, at the time, very large house with a second story upstairs, bedrooms upstairs, two bedrooms downstairs. They had running water. They had a well up top and it came down the hill. So they had running water in the house. At one point, they had a toilet. I don't know how that worked, but they found it was sort of inadequate, so they went back to what everybody else had, which was just the good old back house. There was wood stove in the kitchen, stone fireplace in the living room overlooking the water, and it had coal oil heat in the bedrooms. It was pretty comfortable. My grandfather and his assistants fenced 68 acres, deer-proofed the house and garden, planted lawns, orchards, ornamental trees, and they built a derrick down on the front of the property to lift the freight stuff off the boat, which was in the summertime. They would take the boat around to Bedwell Harbor, and in the wintertime, they would take the horse up and down the hills. At one point, they had two horses. As far as the boats were concerned, where the first thing that the kids remembered was when they bought a 32-foot Japanese fish boat, which my grandmother quite liked because it was unsinkable. It was really steady and just a great boat. They had it stripped down and they put cabins in it, and it was powered by a 2-cylinder Frisbee engine so they can carry their freight back and forth in the summertime, pick up their mail and all those other things. They also had two dinghies, multiple rafts and poles, and at one point, a fisherman's dory bobbled into the bay, and they accepted it, and they had that for a couple of years as well. And then one night, it decided to bobble out again in a storm. Arthur went after it, but it was dark and choppy and very unfriendly out there, and he decided it had some place to go, so they forfeited it. The kids used to, well, they all did. They'd get on the boat in the summertime, and they'd go for about a week or two, just cruising the islands, checking out strange places that they hadn't been to before, and had a wonderful time. They'd go in and make campfires, sit and make their campfires on land, and then bunk out on the decks on the boat for the summer. But the whole time they were doing that, they would only see fishermen, tugboats, working boats, no strangers or cruisers or ferries. The kids were very active. They were up first thing in the morning. They were doing something. They're always. And their days were well laid out and well planned. My grandfather was an organized person. The kids would have daily chores, like obviously looking after their beds, getting things as soon as they got up. That was done, no dilly-dallying around. Then they had to collect wood. If it was the summertime, they'd go off early, down to the beach, collecting wood, and then they'd have to chop it and store it. And they had the big porch to do things on. They had the pump to do every morning. They had to go and pump that water down to the house. As it grew, their property grew. The kids were always doing, and they had lots of free time, and they had their schooling. Then they had cows to milk. Anyway, besides chores, they had a lot of things to do. For one thing, they mastered the ability of what they called tree topping, and they would start at one end of the property and get on a top of a tree and reach over and grab the top of the next one and let go of the first one, and they would spring. And they go from tree to tree all the way down to the road at the main road with only one incident, and that was little Mary. She would have been the second child, and she broke her arm one time when she grabbed the wrong kind of a branch, but they had a ball doing that. Then they had their gym equipment, which my grandfather had made, an incredible array of rings and swings and everything you can imagine. They were always rowing. Every time they had visitors or friends, I guess they did have the occasional visitor from England, my grandmother would send the kids off out in the boat, take them out sightseeing, and away they go. So they spend a lot of time rowing people around. Oh, then there was the pastors. My grandmother, of course, treated them very well. And the kids were really resentful that the pastors would get the best parts of the dinner, take the meat out of the casseroles and things like this. This is the student pastors, not the regular. The regular pastors were wonderful friends of my grandmother's. The new young fellows, she looked after just as well, of course, but the kids resented it because they were probably starving themselves. Had these awful boats that they had to sail around in from island to island in the worst weather. They didn't have a very happy job. And so they were less than popular with the kids. And my grandmother doted on them all, of course. One story that my mom told me was of one of these particular pastors. The kids took them up for a hike, and he was supposed to be teaching them about the Bible. But as they walked, this fellow was knocking off the heads of the flowers on the side of the road, on the side of the path. And the kids were just horrified. They were all very, very into nature and these sorts of things. I couldn't believe that an adult person would be so destructive just for no reason at all, but just walking. So they kind of signaled each other and they all ran ahead up this hot, high, high hill. I think it might have been the peak from something else that I was reading. And they got up to the top where they were supposed to get their lesson. And they decided to teach him a lesson. And they all climbed a tree and wouldn't come down. So he stood there and berated them, which they completely ignored, unconcerned. And eventually he got tired and turned around and went back down the hill again. In retrospect, my mother always felt bad about it when she was older. But at the time, they were only worried about what their mother was going to say. Unfortunately, she appeared not to have mentioned it to them. But this was the sort of things that I think the island was very used to hearing stories about these rather wild children. Every night, my grandfather would read by the big fireplace in the living room. The classics, of course, which was highly enjoyed by Midge, who was the oldest. The second oldest would always go to sleep immediately. My uncle, the young boy, Alan, thought they were very interesting. And my mother just loved sitting there and listening. She didn't care about the stories. They were way over her head. But the idea of the fire crackling and her mother knitting and her father reading these stories and enjoying themselves very much. And that was a nightly thing. That was part of their education, actually. There was another story my mother had about the fact that they were all out running around. She said her poor mother would have had a heart attack if she'd known some of the things that they got into. But one that she did know about was my mother, as the youngest, was cornered on a ledge on a cliff with an octopus, which was coming out of the water. And, of course, they were all terrified. They'd never seen one close like that before. The kids all went screaming off and left her sitting on this ledge with the octopus. And Mom said she looked at it, and it looked at her. And she figured that it probably was almost as scared as she was, so she didn't move and she just stared at it. And he sort of slithered around a little bit, but he kept staring at her until finally my grandfather arrived and said, "For heaven's sakes, it's an octopus." And she said, you know, basically the kids, if they'd taken the time, they probably could have got her off that ledge. She couldn't do it herself, but she needed a lift instead of, you know, running off screaming. But in her notes, she said, for some reason, they all decided that was the way to go when there was an emergency. The three of them would run to get my grandfather, but leave the poor victim all by themselves. So they weren't very well organized in terms of emergencies. The outcome of all their cliff climbing and whatever they were doing out there running around was that they were very confident kids. For being rather cut off from a larger community, they didn't have any problems at all. And one of the stories that my mom tells me was Auntie Mary running into a dentist that they once went to. They used to come in every 6 months or so to the dentist, and they always stayed at the Strathcona Hotel. The dentist, Dr. Foote, later retired to Pender Island. And one of the stories that he told Mary was the first time he came out to the office to get the next victim, as my mother used to call them, he found three little girls lined up on the ledge, three stories above the city, with their feet swinging out over the street, watching all the activity downstairs with you know, great enthusiasm. He nearly had a heart attack. And another one of the things that she talked about was going out in the early mornings, as they did, along the water shore, coming across one of the smugglers during the Prohibition. They didn't even see it. It was well hidden in a little cove, and it was dark grayish color. And when they got close enough, they realized that there were these men sleeping all over the deck. And so they backtracked and found out that this was very common. They were around the islands a lot. Another time, I think it was my mother, was crossing the Spalding property where they weren't supposed to go at after dark. And she was crossing the path, and she heard two smugglers making contact through whistles, which she had heard about on the island, but she'd never actually been in between them before, which was fairly unnerving to her. I think she probably was fairly young, because she seemed to be really quite taken with the drama of these people sneaking around after dark when they were all in bed. But I've never heard anyone else mention it, the incidents. She tells me, us, anybody who reads her little memoirs that she wrote late in her life, that there was a shootout in Bedwell Harbor, which was 17 shots exchanged between smugglers and hijackers, and blood poured out. There was nobody died, but somebody was shot. And it was quite a thing in her memory. But that was one of their early morning forays, when they first found these guys sneaking off into the cove to sleep. One of the huge events on the island that everybody talked about and everybody participated in, the picnics, was constant picnics on the beach. Everybody would join in as they encountered them. And hockey games, what you call street hockey on a field, I guess, field hockey. Everybody would be out there, the old men and the little kids, and everybody bashing and smashing, and they had a ball. The school teacher talks about it in her account as well. She would take part. She was, according to her, holding up her skirts and trying to stay out of the way of the puck, but eventually got involved in it too. That was a very big thing, and there are several photos around of the island hockey games. There were no medical facilities on the island at that time. Amazingly enough, there was only a few serious incidents. One of them was at a time when my mother was kicked in the stomach by her horse. It was spring, and they were going to school. Mom got too close to its back legs, and it was feeling pretty frisky, and she got nailed. My grandfather insisted that the kids go to school. He sent them off to school and quickly got my mother into the old Natal, the boat with the 2-horsepower engine, and he putt-putts over to Sydney. She remembers just feeling like death. They got into Sydney, and then they went to visit friends until the bus came. It was a hot, hot day. They had to walk from the house to the highway where they caught the bus. Then they got on the bus, and it was a long, bumpy ride into town. And they got to the doctor, and the doctor took one look at her, called a taxi, and sent her a block to the hospital. This must have been towards the end of the day by the time she got there. She ended up being in the hospital for 2 weeks, I think it was, but managed to avoid any long-term problems. At the time of the tree topping, when the kids were springing from tree to tree, Mary fell and broke her arm, and there was no help, of course. But Mrs. Spaulding's sisters had moved in with them, and they were World War I vets, and they decided that they could probably do something, so they mended up Mary's arm, patched up her arm. By the time they realized that it wasn't really working, she had to have it rebroken and set in Victoria. I think they took her into the hospital, and that was not a very good idea. The kids, they were very small at this point when they were doing their wood collecting. Annie Midge got her head in the way of my mother's axe. My mother being the smallest, so she must have been three. She was cutting the kindling, and Auntie Midge stuck her head in the way, apparently, as the story goes, and just peeled back the scalp. So they went down to the farm of old Dr. Aldrich, who was retired. He had been a very upper-class London surgeon who was quite unconcerned about this little cut that she had on her head, and he sat her on a chair and poured a bottle of mercurochrome on it. I remember that stuff. And sewed her up with his wife's sewing kit, and it healed without a scratch, without a sign. Didn't even have a bald patch. It was perfect. And the only other incident they had was that one summer, my grandmother decided the children needed to meet more children, and she sent them to summer camp on Thetis Island, which, of course, they hated. Mum said it was exactly the same as where they always were, only they weren't allowed to do anything. They made them wear shoes, and they made them, you know, eat at certain times. Well, of course, they did that at home, but, you know, she wasn't used to the food at all. One thing they gave her was bologna, which she couldn't figure out what it was. She wasn't sure that it was edible at all. And the only thing they came home with was impetigo. So much for shoes, she said in her little story. And now she's got my poor grandmother, four kids with impetigo on her hands. So they telephoned to Terry's Pharmacy in Victoria and asked what they could do. And he said he would send them something. And the impetigo just went crazy. I guess Mum said they were a real mess. And it probably took about 2 weeks for the little package to come. And they got some Calmine lotion to put on it. By then, it was the worst of it was over. And that was the medical system. That's all they had. And I don't know what other people did, but the crane monsters managed okay. The other thing that the cranes were very involved with was the church. Strangely enough, because they didn't start the church until 37 and 38, when they arranged the land and we're finding there were more people now who could support church. So my grandmother Dora and her sister, her half-sister Christine, were very involved in the church, of course, and cared very much. And at that time, people from England would write home when they were opening a church, and their families and their contacts would gather a few things and send them along. That's how they managed to build churches away from the old country. So my grandmother provided the altar cloth and the communion linen, and her half-sister donated her father's stained glass window, which he had designed and built. He was an architect, and that was the Good Shepherd window, which stands today. And the other thing my Dora Jane did in her enthusiasm for the church was she managed to get hold of some acorns from an oak in the park at Buckingham Palace, which England had distributed to the colonies through certain contacts and florists and things like that at the commemoration of King George the 6 in May 37. So Dora Jane went down and got the acorn, and she and Alan went down and planted it at the church, which is a big golden oak that is still standing there. In 1931, my grandmother got very sick, and they never did know exactly what was wrong with her. She was extremely depressed. She could not cope. She could not help my grandfather in any way. The two girls, two younger girls, had to go to high school. They'd never been to school before. Oh, they did. My grandmother, when she, the first year that she was ill, the girls went to grade 8 at the island school for the first time. And then the family split so that my grandfather would take the two youngest girls. They bought a house in Esquimalt, and they went to school there. And then they would switch, and Dora Jane would come in and look after the two youngest ones, and my grandfather, Arthur, would go back to the island, do the work that he had to do to maintain it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they would switch every 2 weeks. And then my grandmother just really became too ill to even do that. So he had to try and sell the house. It didn't sell. He couldn't sell Camp Bay. It was 68 acres and a large house. And nobody had much money at that time, 31. I guess that was depression. So that was difficult. Mary and my mother started at Lamson Street School, grade 9. And the first day of school, the teacher introduced them to the class and asked Mom, as an introduction, where did you stand in your school year? Mom said first, and the class went, ooh. And then she said, oh, that's very good. Mary, where did you stand? And Mary said, second. Mom said she knew what was coming. And the teacher said, and how many people were you in your class? And Mary said, 2, because they were the only grade 8s in Pender Island. That was actually quite fun, because she said it. Many years later, when they started having regular reunions at the Lamson Street School, they were probably in their 70s by then, everybody remembered that story. And they all remember it specifically, either being terribly embarrassed or thinking it was hilariously funny or whatever it was. It was one thing they all had in common after all those years was this anecdote. When they first moved over to Esquimalt, it was a difficult time adjusting, because it certainly wasn't Pender Island. And my grandmother used to say that the ugliest part of the city was walking across that bridge from Esquimalt to town. She just hated it. So she started filling up her apron pockets with poppy seeds, and she spread orange California poppy seeds everywhere she went on the walk along Esquimalt Avenue around the area of the bridge. And when I first came to Victoria, one of the first things I did was take a picture of that bridge with the poppies on both sides. It was they were just thick down both sides. And I didn't hear the story until later about that. Even after all the construction, there's little pockets of those orange poppies still there, which is kind of a nice feeling. But she also got very enthused about the opening of the church here on Pender. When the oldest child, Midge, first moved to Victoria from the island, she moved over to stay with friends while she finished her grades 10 and 11. And she was the first in her class and the highest female student in BC as a result of the homeschooling that they got through their parents. And my mom, to her, to the day she died, would constantly come out with uncommon words that you normally wouldn't use in conversation. All of a sudden, something would come out just, you know, like loquacious or something like that, that you just wouldn't, in normal conversation, use that word. And it all her life, every so often, she'd come out with one of these words, not intentionally, it just triggered. Another part of the reason that people may have thought that they stayed to themselves a lot was the fact that they were homeschooled. My grandparents got a course from England that was very well thought of, apparently, and it was obviously very effective because it's a huge range of things that they were teaching. My grandmother had no education herself. I mean, I doubt she had very much. I don't know that for a fact. I know she didn't have anything beyond the very basics. And my grandfather was self-taught, but very self-disciplined as well. So they followed the course meticulously. Grandfather had that all structured as well as their regular chores and things that they had to do. They would have the morning broken down. They would have a strict lunch. They would have an early afternoon. And my grandmother would teach the fun things, I think, like English and French and that sort of thing. My grandfather would take the maths. And then they'd switch and they'd do two kids at a time. The older ones would go with my grandfather and take the math and geometry and whatnot. My grandmother would teach the younger ones. And then they'd switch in the afternoon and the rest of the day was their own. Chores done, education done. Bam, off they go rock climbing. What I forgot about Alan was that, of course, he was a boy, so they get to a certain age and they're not, you know, he was doing his own thing for a certain extent, but he wanted very, very deeply to join the Navy. And my grandfather was very supportive of that. And he wanted him to apply as an officer, of course. And they turned him down because his birth certificate said he was illegitimate or he didn't have a father on his. There was no father on his birth certificate, and they would not accept him for an application for the Navy. So he went in, which he was going to anyway. He took his training as an engineer. Artificer? Do you know what an artificer is? Neither do I, but I read in a book, a naval book, that it is a big deal, that it's a very accomplished system. He's basically responsible for everything mechanical in that boat, an overview of everything. And he loved the Navy the first year he joined, but the war started and they sent him on a convoy and his ship was sunk. Friendly fire. He wasn't fired on, actually. They had a collision. He was then sidelined, sent to England to wait, and then they were going to send him home on survivor's duty. He got picked up by his ship in England when it was finally ready. It had been bombed at some point and was being fixed. So they sent it to England, picked him up. They got halfway across the ocean and it ran into another member of their convoy a second time. And it went down and they all drowned. Yeah, that was pretty horrible. Annie Midge went to nursing school and she graduated first in her class. And then she got TB as a result of working too hard and being put into the TB ward. Then she was sidelined for a year to recover. And in that time, the half-sister, Christina, was having heart trouble. So Marjorie nursed her. My grandmother was getting sicker. My grandfather was having money trouble. The two younger girls, they had a ball. Mary went to agricultural school, UBC. My mom went to art school in Vancouver, and then they all got married, and Dora and Arthur bought a little house in View Royal on the water, and then she died in 48, 68 years of age. My grandfather moved in with the oldest daughter, Annie Midge, and he died in 1960 at 84. And that was the end of the Cranes. I think that my impressions of the island have always been based on the fact that my mother and Auntie Mary were inseparable their whole lives, even when they were both in the military families. Their husbands were in the military, and they were all over the world. They still managed to crisscross regularly, and they were just like a couple of little kids together. And it was a bond that, I mean, you were there. They never specifically talked about the childhood, but you can tell that it was a very strong bond with them. It was something about them. I used to talk to David Spaulding about this. There was something about the bond that they had with Camp Bay that they never lost the love of. Mary retired as fast as she could back to that island. That wasn't in the cards for Mom because my father was not an island person in any way. But the girls had some secret pact between them because of their childhood. They were both extremely optimistic people, very strong in their own beliefs, very into nature. They both had a very high tolerance for pain. They were no fuss people. They didn't spend a lot of time thinking about themselves or being particularly, they didn't share emotionally. It was hard to get on a personal level with them. For me, I don't think it was just me. I think they bonded with that island in a way that I couldn't put my finger on. That I think in a way, as David and I discussed, because he understood that, not for himself, but he felt very much the same way. And he felt that he'd missed out on it, that they did have something that they shared with each other that did not belong to anybody else. I guess that's what it was. That's what it felt like to me. As close as I was to my mother and my aunt, both, I was not a part of that thing that they held so close to themselves. My grandparents started out heading for that island because they had both had such unhappy childhood on either end of the spectrum. He was neglected and she had more than everything and nothing. And they wanted their kids to just experience childhood and enjoy it. And that was really their intention. And they did it. And I think they did a great job of it.
Thank you very much to Lynn for doing this interview. This interview and the entire series has been made possible with funding from the Capital Regional District, the Pender Island Community Resource Center, the Wasanich Leadership Council, Wasanich School Board, the Pender Islands Museum, and the South Pender Historical Society. Thank you to all these organizations for contributing to make these recordings possible.